I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world,
ever.
Ever.
W is for War and Peace.
Or Jeffrey Alexander McCormack. So, War and Peace was his nom de plume working with David Bowie.
Yes.
And, well, I'll tell you what, here's a great thing. So, when we're doing the research for this podcast, sometimes it's very, very easy. Like, for instance, Woody Woodmansey hasn't got a particularly great Wikipedia.
No, not at all.
Woody needs to look at that.
Yeah, he does.
Or get his people to do it, I do.
If he's interested.
If he's interested. Yeah. He's probably not, actually. But he has obviously got his book Spider from Mars. Mm. And Mick Ronson never got round to writing an autobiography, but there's a brilliant book, The Spider with the Platinum Hair,
that's
Weird
right.
and Gilly.
That's right.
And so we can delve into those, and of course there are various other books, and Jeff does get mentions in Any Day Now, but there's not loads about him in there, is there?
No, not at all.
Okay. And so I very cheekily got a hold of Jeff and asked him if he would be kind enough to fill in all of the gaps, because we know loads about what he did with David,
yeah,
but we didn't know too much about the background, his early days and all that kind of stuff. And of course we do know that he met David at a very early age.
Yes.
And he's given us a load of information, and a lot of it is culled from his brilliant books, From Station to Station, which came out in 2007 on Genesis.
Great.
And I know he's working on an updated version of it as well. So we'll get to the stuff that Jeff sent through in a short while. But I first was in the same room as Jeff when David Bowie did the session for Mark Radcliffe and I at Maida Vale.
Mm.
And we'd met Bowie a couple of times at that point. And we were obviously just beside ourselves. It was just a massive moment for Mark Radcliffe and I. And there were loads of people invited and they stood on the gantry there at Maida Vale Studio 4. But when the word came out that War and Peace was turning up, the buzz just went up several notches, I tell you.
Cause wow.
Because
okay.
He's a mythical figure, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Nobody knew too much about him, apart from what he'd done with David. But he was omnipresent, and everybody knew that him and David were like that. Now, this isn't a TV item. I've got my fingers crossed together like that.
I can see it. I can see him.
They were like that. And so for him to arrive, everybody got a real buzz about that. And so it was great, you know. And I've met him on several occasions, met him in London. He also came up and did an amazing show, and I'm forever grateful, on the anniversary of David's passing.
Oh, yeah.
It was a remarkable programme, just because Jeff, he's obviously so close to David, and it obviously just tore him apart when David passed. But he doesn't spill the beans, you know. He wasn't tipping up on everything, talking about David and being the big I am and all that. Mm. He just, you know, he guarded his grief.
Yeah.
He did a couple of things, you know, and I was really honoured that he did our programme, and it was so great. And also, most recently, I spent some time with Jeff and Joe, his partner, brilliant people, at the Finding Fame screening in London.
Yeah.
And we had a great night, really, really brilliant. But they're my experiences of Jeff and Joe. And we're going to look at his career, aren't we? But you've also cross-pollinated with him, haven't you?
Yeah, I can't compete with that, though. I really can't. But I think when it would be the anniversary reissue of David Live came out. I'm guessing around 2004. Sometimes they're a year later, aren't they, 2005. So I did a Q&A with him for Uncut magazine, which, sadly, I've lost somehow. So
oh,
I'd love
no.
to know what was involved in all that. Obviously, we were talking about David Live, but we were talking about the entire Diamond Dogs tour, of course, you know, and everything went on in 74. And I know there's some great stuff in there. So I will, it's possibly in a drawer somewhere, or, you know.
You've got so many
it.
Interviews in your archive, haven't you? It's just ridiculous.
I have.
And we were talking before, and I sent you through a link so it was from the Tower Ballroom, 1974.
Yeah.
And it surfaced quite recently. And I sent a link to Jeff okay, and it is them doing the Gene Genie, and it is just incredible. I mean, I was so happy to see it. It's black and white. I was so happy to see it, but at the same time, it just rubs salt in the wound that we never got the tour. But the great thing is, I can never pronounce the other guy with Jeff, so I won't bother. no offence, but I'll just make a fool of myself again.
No, that's fine.
But there's the really, really great stuff with Bowie sat on a chair, and they're all moving around like musical chairs, and leaning over into each other's microphones and being very dramatic and quite hammy and having a laugh. And there's a bit where Bowie covers up his cobblers with his hands and that kind of stuff. But there's a great bit also where they're doing Footsie.
Yeah, they do that a few times, don't they?
Yeah, great. And you just think this is just Bowie was having a hoot here. So if you think about it, we spoke to Herbie Flowers for Cheap Things, and he was great. And they were talking about how a lot of the time the musicians were all behind the stage.
That's right.
You know, they were hidden, weren't they, largely? Yeah, yeah. And so all that really was to be seen, as far as I can make out, was the three of them, more often than not. And there's David with his Bezzy mate just gagging about on stage, doing one of the best tours ever and singing some of the best tunes ever. So they were having a riot, by the way.
It was a brilliant routine, and all the more amazing to think that he was playing sort of quite big places at that point. And he wasn't playing stadiums, but they're pretty decent theatres, you know. And it's just three blokes and three wooden chairs. That's the great thing about it. As you say, they're having a laugh, they're messing about, but it's choreographed. Of course it's choreographed, and it's brilliantly as well. Tony Basil involved in all that, you know. So she came up with these ideas, and Bowie would throw ideas back at her, and somehow they worked it out. But you would never see that these days. Why would you, three wooden chairs on a stage for a major artist? It just wouldn't happen.
I mean, there were other things in there. Obviously, you'd be juxtaposed against having a cherry picker coming out and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that routine, it was almost like slapstick, wasn't it? And it just really did give you a great example of the mischief that Bowie had in him, and obviously Jeff as well. Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at them just gagging about, and like I say, and it's great, all the footsie and all that kind of stuff, but then eventually they're all kind of like putting their hands across each other, and Bowie grabs his cobblers like, you know, he's in a line on a football match.
Yeah, that's right.
A free kick. And it just gave you a great idea of the friendship that was going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you know, I mean, Jeff was Bowie's constant companion, you know, from Aladdin Sane right through until the LA years.
Yeah,
he?
That's right, yeah.
You know? And so we're going to try and document it as best as we possibly can. But I can just vouch for War and Peace, Jeff McCormack being just an absolute 100%, as my dad used to say.
Oh, okay. So as we know, he's English vocalist, composer and dancer, best known for his work with Bowie in the 70s.
So, do you know, War and Peace, so that was the nom de plume given, we know that. And also, Rock and Roll With Me was co-written by Jeff, okay?
Yeah.
So it's credited to Bowie and War and Peace.
Hmm.
And Jeff told me this, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying it. He never received royalties for it,
right?
Because Tony DeFreeze insisted that War and Peace was a nom de plume, another identity for David Bowie.
Is that right?
Yeah, wow. Which is just incredible, really. I mean, so he did it. He changed his name, wrote this song. I think he started it on the piano. We'll probably get to that at some point. And Bowie picked up on it, and they wrote it together. But yeah, it just Smoke and Mirrors just got rid of it.
Absolutely. I mean, you imagine the royalties from that, eh? Oh. Yeah.
Okay, anyway, so on to War and Peace, Jeff's musical career. We'll call him Jeff from here on in.
All right.
So, Jeff, a longtime friend of Bowie since their school days in Bromley. Peace, initially as G.A. McCormack, contributed backing vocals to a number of albums, beginning with Aladdin Sane in 1973 and continuing through to Station to Station in 1976.
He appeared with Bowie during his 1973 tour of the States and Japan, travelling back to the UK via the Trans-Siberian Railway with the singer, who refused to fly. He then performed on the final UK leg of the tour, which ended with Ziggy Stardust's retirement at the Hammersmith Odeon in July.
Okay, so with Bowie, Peace co-wrote the music for Rock and Roll With Me on Diamond Dogs, and later Turn Blue on Iggy Pop's Lust for Life. He also appeared as an astronaut dancer and vocalist in the 1980 Floor Show television special with Bowie in October 73, and as one of the Diamond Dogs dancers vocalists on Bowie's 1974 US tour. With fellow astronauts Ava Cherry and Jason Guess, and Bowie as writer-producer, Peace recorded an album's worth of material at Olympic Studios in late 1973, which was eventually released as People From Bad Homes in 1995. There's some great stuff on there as well, actually.
Yeah, there is. And as you just mentioned there, in 2007, he published From Station to Station, Travels with Bowie 1973 to 76, which was an illustrated account of all his time in Bowie's entourage.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
Right, we're going to do a Chuckle Brothers now on the discography, are we not,
Bob? We are, so let's start with Bowie, of course. Aladdin Sane, he's backing vocals on Watch That Man and Panic in Detroit.
Yeah, Pin-Ups, backing vocals on Here Comes the Night, See Emily Play, Everything's All Right, I Can't Explain, Friday on My Mind, Sorrow, Shapes of Things, Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere, and Where Have All the Good Times Gone, that's the whole
album. That's more or less everything. I think there's probably one tune he's not on. Diamond Dogs, as you mentioned, co-composer on Rock and Roll With Me.
David Lie, backing vocals and co-composer, same tune.
Backing vocals on Station to Station.
And then, of course, Ziggy Stardust, the motion picture, had to be there. And Bowie at the Beeb, backing vocals as Jeffrey Alexander. So that was, again, a famous part of Bowie's career, that he did the David Bowie and Friends for John Peel, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, and just mentioned that he was co-composer of Turn Blue on Iggy's Lust for Life in 77. And you've mentioned People from Bad Homes from the Astronauts.
Yeah, right. And again, previously mentioned in this section, Kevin Can and his book Any Day Now, which is a really, really thorough kind of a look at David's life. But I mean, yeah, there isn't that much of Jeff in it, and that's why we went to him initially.
Yeah, so this is from Kevin Can's book about Jeff. In June 1954, whilst living in Bromley, David Jones, stroke Bowie, befriended schoolmate Jeff McCormack, who lived in neighbouring Cambridge Road. 3 years later, Jones, McCormack and George Underwood sang together in St Mary's Choir.
Later, in the late 60s, McCormack worked for designer Michael Fish at his boutique in Clifford Street, Marylebone. He introduced Bowie to Fish, who sold him two medieval-style velvet gowns.
Alongside Underwood, Dana Gillespie and Mark Pritchett, McCormack was involved when Bowie did an in-concert radio show for John Peel in June 71. This marked Trevor Boulder's first appearance with Bowie. McCormack often served as Bowie's travelling companion while on tour. In January 73, having been invited along as backing vocalist and extra percussionist, he and Bowie boarded the SS Canberra at Southampton, bound for New York.
On arrival, they checked into the Gramercy Park Hotel 5 days later on the 30th of January.
When the tour moved on to Philadelphia in mid-February, playing 7 shows at the Tower Theatre, McCormack remembered, Bowie stalked his audience like a tiger. By the end, he'd be holding them entirely in his sweaty hands. There was the sweet rock and roll trick of getting to that moment of thanking the audience and saying goodnight, pretending not to know there's going to be an encore. Night after night, it'd be the best part of the show.
When it came time to leave for Japan on the 19th of March 1973, he and Bowie boarded the SS Oronsi as it sailed from Los Angeles. They stopped off in San Francisco the following day, deciding to spend the night ashore because they weren't happy with their berth. They met up with Bette Midler and went to a small club called a boarding house. Back on board the ship, it finally docked at Yokohama just over 2 weeks later. So the thing is also, for Jeff's benefit as well, just a byproduct of Bowie's fear of flying, they'd get off and travel in luxury and go around on all these cruise ships and everything when the spiders are just flitting back and forth on planes.
Amazing. Just, you know, that two-week journey to Japan. Fantastic. Yeah. On the journey home from there, a boat headed to Vladivostok, where they were due to pick up the Trans-Siberian Express. Bowie and McCormack improvised a cabaret act and performed Space Oddity and Amsterdam for their fellow passengers.
Wow.
When it came time to record Pin-Ups at the Chateau d'Hérouville just outside Paris in July 73, the sessions for the album were interrupted by Lulu and McCormack's loud vocal warm-ups. We had to stop because we could hear them, but couldn't find them, Trevor Boulder said later. Eventually, they emerged from the reverb room, which half deafened them, I think.
On the 18th of October 1973, during the filming of Bowie's midnight special show, the 1980 Floor Show, at the Marquee, the newly formed Astronettes performed on the stage. The band is led by Ava Cherry, with Jason Guest and McCormack, who has adopted the name War and Peace.
So that's where it came from, do you think, for the 1980 Floor Show?
Looks like it.
In March 74, Bowie and McCormack travelled to Paris to meet the film director and stage producer John Dexter to discuss presentation ideas for touring Diamond Dogs. When it came time for the recording of the album itself, McCormack shared a writing credit, as you mentioned, with Bowie on Rock and Roll With Me, after coming up with the basic chords at the piano.
So there's a book. We've got so many Bowie books and that, but some of them are like really, really plush and lush and amazing and pretty expensive. Yes. I mean, probably worth every penny. I've not seen inside Jeff's book, and I'm hoping and I'm thinking that there's going to be a kind of revised, updated version of Station to Station. Mm. But what I've seen of it, and obviously on occasion, the photographs, the legion of photographs that Jeff took of David, have tipped up here and there, and not least on his website. But it looks like a truly amazing book, and so I'm just waiting with bated breath for that. It's one of those that you look at it and you think, should have.
It was published by Genesis, who specialise in these luxury books, and they were signed, weren't they? The first 250 copies, I think, signed by Jeff and Bowie. And at the time, I did I just couldn't justify laying out hundreds of pounds for that.
I know, but you wished you had now.
It'd be worth a fortune now.
Yeah,
but anyway.
And he also has exhibitions of his photography.
Yeah.
But the weirdest, I tell you, this is a weird escapade. I was just sat downstairs, because we record this podcast in my house, don't we, Bob?
We do, yes.
And I was watching the TV, and it was that Location, Location, Location programme.
Oh, yeah.
And I was sat there, and this tiny little house came on. So the front of it was not much wider than the front door.
Mm.
And then it tapered out. So it was a triangle, basically.
Yes.
And it just utilised the space, the tiny space, in between two buildings.
Yeah.
Naturally. And so I was watching it. I was thinking, that's amazing, that. I wonder who had that built then. Bloody hell, that's Jeff. And so I was looking at it, and they didn't make any mention of Jeff's history, his past, or any mention of Bowie or anything. And then they proceeded to go around the house. So he was that small, you would walk in, as I say, just get through the door. They'd walk to the back, and there was almost, as I remember, almost a ladder taking you up, because it was so tiny.
Right.
And so you go up, and then so each different level would have a different purpose, as you would expect. So in a normal house, you would have a kitchen, you know, and maybe a pantry over there, and then you've got the living room and the parlour or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is just like, you go up one, right, that's the living space, if you like. Another one, kitchen, bedroom, and all that kind of stuff. That's as I remember it anyway. And I sent him a text. I said, you're on telly at the moment. He said, yeah, I know, yeah, that's my house. I was like, because you knew the house, didn't you?
I know that. It used to fascinate me, that house. You'd see pictures of it, think, who would live there? Now I know.
Yeah.
Honestly, I used to be fascinated by that, and the idea that, you can use that space, just building it, why not? And now, as you say, it kind of fans out towards the back slightly, because it's this strange triangular shape.
Yeah, so the two buildings either side of it didn't just run parallel to each other. They just went off in different directions. It's just really strange little occurrence.
Wow.
You would hope it would be available on YouTube or something, wouldn't you? Maybe we need to check it
possibly,
out.
Possibly.
Okay, so we're now going to get to the point where we get involved in the stuff that Jeff sent through this morning to us, aren't we, Bob?
We are, yeah. So we should start at the beginning, shouldn't we, really?
Defo.
Jeff McCormack, born 27th of February 1947 in Bromley, Kent. So that's just over a month after Bowie himself.
Yeah.
So this is an extract now taken from the book From Station to Station by Jeff McCormack, 2007.
He said, I first met Davy Jones when we were both 7 or 8 years old at Burnt Ash Primary School in Bromley, Kent. David is, in fact, my second oldest pal. The first is George Underwood, the painter, whom I met at my first school, St. Mary's, also in Bromley. George and David would later become good friends in secondary school, Bromley Tech.
Later still, he says, by some 12 or 13 years, George would not only be creating artwork for David, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust and more, but for Tyrannosaurus Rex, Procol Harum and many others. For some reason, my mother thought that Burnt Ash Primary was a better and more challenging school than St. Mary's and would somehow turn her faltering second son and third child into the gifted student she knew me to be. It didn't. For some reason, it left me even more uninspired. I have a sneaking suspicion it was a school uniform. It was brown.
See, that sense of fashion already creeping in there. My mother also decided a little godliness couldn't hurt my moral development and slow me into St. Mary's Church Choir. The Jones and Underwood clans must have been under the same heavenly guidance, for all three of us ended up in cassocks, surplices and ruffles singing at choir practice and in church on Sundays. Weddings were the best gigs. Not only were you paid 5 shillings, a princely sum in those days, but if the ceremony took place in the week, you got a day off school.
Oh, wow, eh? Oh, if only there were photos. Another activity to bring the three of us together was the 18th Bromley Cub Scouts. The meetings were held, and naturally, at St. Mary's Church Hall. Uniform, green. I wouldn't knock the Cub Scout movement. It was one of my first big adventures to take a camping trip down to the coast, sing a few songs around the campfire, and sleep under the stars.
Many years later, David and I were about to do it all over again, but on a somewhat bigger scale, under different stars with wackier uniforms. Are you all right, mate? I was sitting at a desk in an office in North London, staring into space, stunned. Are you all right, mate? Mike asked again. I've just got a call from David Bowie informing me that I'm now in his band and I'm going to go on a world tour. That's amazing, Mike said. My dad's going too. He's Bowie's driver.
Great. That's great. He continues. We boarded the SS Canberra on the 24th of January, 1973. Just like in the movies, a brass band played on the quayside. I remember thinking how enormous the ship was. It towered above us like some gigantic wedding cake. Apart from a couple of journeys to France by ferry, this is my first experience of cruising.
Initially, I was wary of the courteous manner in which the ship's officers treated us. They looked so smart and precise in their uniforms, quite the opposite of us. It worried me. I couldn't help thinking that, once we were far out to sea, they might sidle up to us with a Jack Nicholson grin and say, right, you two freaks, we're in charge now.
We were certainly different to the ship's usual clientele, who, by and large, were middle to old-aged, upper-middle-class Britons and Americans in semi-retirement. We were shown to our suite, which included 2 bedrooms and a large lounge, and went back on deck. The brass band was still playing jolly little tunes while people waved goodbyes from ship to shore and back again. There was a deep rumbling from the engines, and slowly we pulled away. People waved ever more furiously, as if they'd never see each other again. For my part, I had no idea that I'd be gone for the best part of 3 years.
Wow. It took a day and a half to realise that near complete inactivity is par for the course on a cruise ship. By day 2, afternoon tea was an exciting event to look forward to. When it came to dinner, we decided to really make an effort and dress up. My fairly conservative clothes and long, dark, curly hair contrasted rather nicely with David's bright red barnet, shaved eyebrows, makeup and exotic handmade Freddie Beretti suits.
He says, we took on the roles of a modern-day Oscar Wilde and Bosie. I'd turn to David while dining and ask, more vegetable, my dear Oscar? He'd look towards the ornate ceiling with a look of disdain and say, I find vegetables so very vulgar. To arrive in New York for the first time by air would have been a culture shock. Arriving by sea, senses lulled by the gentle pace of the Canberra, it was something like a bungee jump on amyl nitrate. Everything seemed bigger and brasher than anything I'd ever seen. Cars, trucks, people, and it was both exciting and confusing. We were greeted by various RCA and management staff and led to a waiting limousine.
We were travelling to the Gramercy Park Hotel at 2 Lexington Avenue. The Gramercy is what you would call a traditional hotel. The warm, inviting atmosphere was a perfect antidote to the frenzied drive from the docks. As we sat at a table by a window overlooking a small park, with a pianist tinkling away softly in the background, I recall feeling almost tranquil. It was like being back on board the Canberra. I clearly remember thinking that, at that moment, life could not be sweeter.
Oh, how nice. Situated at 213 Park Avenue South, between 17th and 18th, just off Union Square, Max's was a late 60s, early 70s mecca for film stars, rock stars, artists and photographers. Many of Max's regular patrons were famous or went on to become so. Willem de Kooning, Julian Schnabel, Larry Rivers and Andy Warhol were frequent visitors, and on any night you'd usually find a Jagger, Lennon or a Lou Reed, as well as a couple of smart film stars looking out of place amidst the rest of the druggy, dressed-down punters.
Max's was run by a man called Mickey Ruskin. Invariably, he'd stand at the door vetting the clientele. Upstairs, a small music room had previously played host to the Velvet Underground, Iggy Pop and the New York Dolls, amongst others. We knew David Johansen, lead singer of the Dolls, and his Marilyn Monroe-alike girlfriend, Sindra Fox. And with half of Bowie's management team being ex-Warhol associates, we had a ready-made Max's posse.
In London, David had played me an album by somebody called Biff Rose. I hate to admit it, but I just didn't get it. Of course, I didn't say so, coward that I am. I was still grateful to David for turning me on to Van Morrison's wonderful Astral Weeks. It was very important to me to find a white singer who sang soul music without mimicking black singers. So, not wanting to appear ungrateful, I went along with David's proclamations of Biff's genius.
This was always a bad idea. At best, you end up unwrapping the best of Biff, or Santa and Johnny play Biff Rose every Christmas for the rest of your life. At worst, you get an evening with Biff Rose live at Max's Kansas City.
Oh, I felt such a moron. Surely, if Biff was a stiff, he could never have got a gig at Max's. Upstairs, there seemed to be a distinct lack of audience, not counting David and I sitting at a small table right at the front of the small room. The rest of our posse seemed to have other things to do, like evaporate.
At any rate, Biff came on to a rapturous hand clap from Bowie and did his Biff stuff. And it's at this point that I tell you he was awesome. I was mesmerised. I was blown away. I still didn't get it, actually. In fact, once Biff had boffed, I'm not even sure David was too overwhelmed.
I like it. Then there was a series of dull funereal chords from the very same piano Biff had just finished torturing. This was soon accompanied by a wrist-slashingly depressive vocal. On and on it droned. Was this a prank? Was somebody actually trying to downstage Biff? I looked around the darkened room at the other five members of the audience for clues. Bowie's delicate features had the expression of a man in great pain. Groany, moany, groan, went the singer, and we eyed up the exit. But we still had full glasses of beer and felt duty-bound to finish them. Lucky we did, too.
As we concentrated on downing the amber liquid as fast as we could, Mr. Moan strapped on a Fender Telecaster and was joined by a band. He then launched into one of the most amazing songs, one of the most amazing sets I've ever witnessed. The song was called Does a Bus Stop at 42nd Street. The band, the E Street Band. The artist, Bruce Springsteen. The album, Greetings from Ashbury Park, was on our turntables the next morning. Thanks, Biff.
Fancy
so they got
that.
Something out of it in the end anyway.
Absolutely. The band I joined at the beginning of 1973 was basically an extension of Bowie's original Spiders. Apart from Mike Garson, who was already installed on piano and Mellotron, I was one of four new recruits with Ken Fordham and Brian Wilshaw on sax and flutes, John Hutchinson on rhythm guitar and backing vocals, and me on percussion and backing vocals. We all stood at one side of the stage, Mike Garson the other.
I have to admit that it was like having a backstage pass but being allowed to join in. However, it was interesting to witness, at such close quarters, how hard his Bowie-ness worked for his supper. Not that I knew it then, but he would require considerably more effort from me in future shows.
He continues, Brian Wilshaw was pretty quiet, but Ken Fordham was a laugh. He had a typical jobbing muso's philosophy on life. One day this, the next day that. He'd been playing some kind of ghastly lounge music at Heathrow Airport before he got the Bowie gig. David and I immediately renamed him Ken Funky Fordham on account of the fact he was spectacularly unfunky. When introducing the band, David would announce him as such. Ken saw the irony and always took a little bow.
The tour opened at Radio City Music Hall in New York. David told me that it was a place he most wanted to play in the whole city. He took me there for a quick recce beforehand, and we watched a show that was as camp as the venue itself. When the famous Rockettes dance troupe came on to perform their precision high-kicking dance routine, it made Bowie even more determined to play there. Against all the odds, his wish came true.
We rehearsed the show at a big sound stage owned by the record company RCA. I knew the material pretty well, as I'd already done some backing vocals for the Aladdin Sane album, which David was gradually working into the live shows. Hutch, who had worked with David in the 60s on projects like Feathers, had no problem learning the new material. The brass section, like most session musicians, read their parts, played them, and looked at their watches.
On the night, Bowie was fantastic. However, right at the end of the show, something rather strange happened. As we finished the last number, a fan managed to get through security, jump on stage and get within touching distance of David. David seemed to somehow, sort of, collapse. The fan was ejected and David carried to his dressing room, where he recovered to find a sea of extremely worried faces. I'm still not sure what had befallen him.
Right. As for me, the first time I ever performed on a stage is distinguished by the following three facts. It was with David Bowie, it was at New York's Radio City Music Hall, and Salvador Dali was in the audience. That's fairly surreal.
It sure is. And yeah, it was well reported, wasn't it? There was a live review of that show with Bowie fainting at the end of it.
There was, yes, yeah.
And it was well documented. And Jeff also told me, I mean, and it is in Woody's book, actually, but of course, Woody and June were getting married at the end of the Aladdin Sane tour in 1973. And as I remember, Woody hadn't sent out any official invites, but Bowie and Mick Ronson were both meant to be there to give June away and to be the best man.
Yeah.
And neither turned up.
Yes.
As we know, because obviously Woody was on his way out of the band, already out of the band. And so to stand in for David and Mick was Jeff and Trevor Boulder.
Right.
Who ended up performing duties, and Jeff told me that he walked June up the aisle.
Ah, right, okay.
To Parson Garson.
Right.
As he put it. So Mike Garson was the parson, the minister for the wedding.
Oh, wonderful.
But yeah, just to wrap it up, I mean, and again, you know, we'll have to wait and see if Jeff gets his next version of the book out. It will happen, I'm absolutely sure of that. And if you get a chance to go and see him with his exhibition, then you really should. And you can meet him, he's just such a really generous, sweet man and supremely talented as well. So yeah, Jeff McCormack, we salute you. So that's it for this episode of the A to Z of David Bowie. But once again, before you go,
if you'd like to support us along the way and be a member of an exclusive Bowie club, you can. And here's how.
There's an exclusive Bowie members club called Cheap Things. And for just $5 a month, wow, you can be part of it.
Why? So now you're thinking $5 isn't much, but what exactly will I get for my hard-earned cash?
Well, in short, you'll get lots of great new exclusive material delivered to your door.
Well, computer, actually, Mark.
Via a system called Patreon.
That's right. Right, Mark. Patreon is a payment system that allows you to contribute your monthly subscription and offers you a portal to access the exclusive material.
Material such as
interviews with Bowie's cohorts and friends.
There'll be regular filmed Bowie quizzes.
Bowie guitar tutorials.
Unreleased archive written material.
Competitions.
And perhaps most impressively, short films featuring the Cheap Things team.
Ah, that'll be me, Mark, Howard Knock and Jason Reed.
Visiting various Bowie places of interest.
And much more besides.
All this for just $5 a month.
So if you can't resist, simply go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/cheapthings, or one word, and join up.
There's also a website,
bowiecheapthings.com.
Book early.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.